Hello, good morning. You're very welcome to the program. Between now and nine, harvest time in a climate of change, a disease-free future through the appliance of science, hooker racing in Galway Bay, and growing room in Cork as a rooftop farmer goes from a quarter acre to 60. First things first this morning, please, folks. Big thank you to Ella and to Hannah and to Brenda. It's really good to know that there are really good people looking after the shop while RTE has me off on other assignments. But I am back now, feet right in under the desk, and plans are well underway for a lot of interesting programmes over the autumn and the winter. We're going to be doing more river specials along the way. To which end, please get in touch. If you think that there is a river catchment with a special story to tell from the headwater along its course to the estuary, email me, countrywide@rte.ie. To begin, though, up and down the country, an army of combine harvesters has been mobilised. Cereals are being harvested and straw is being saved. A few months ago, the weather was so bad that tillage farmers would have said that they were sowing this year more in hope than expectation of a harvest. But the signs are that victory has been snatched from the jaws of defeat and that there will be a half-decent crop this year. That said, obviously, producing cereals is only becoming more and more challenging thanks to climate change and a poor international price, as I found when I visited the formerly sunny southeast this week.
We look for the moisture of the grain and how hard it is that when you bite it, that it is hard, that it cracks in your teeth, and that gives you a fairly good idea that it is ripe. But
there is very sophisticated equipment to tell you whether the moisture content of your cereal is right for harvesting or not. But for Nicky Keane in Wexford, the bite test still decides whether the combine gets to work or not.
With the combine today.
As I bite that between my teeth now, there's still a little bit of softness in it. So if I come back in an hour or two, would there actually be a crunch to it?
There would, but this field isn't really fully ripe. If we got the sun, a good hot sun on it today, that we call that sun ripe, and you would get to harvest it.
And if you have a half an hour of rain in here now, is it all bets are off?
You're finished for the day, basically. Like, that's it, you're done.
But if you have like a light shower, 5 minutes?
You're done for a couple of hours. It'll have to dry off again. Like, you know, it's just the crop is wet, the moisture goes up, and you have to wait for the crop to dry off.
Stop start,
and you could be cutting here, and half a mile on the road there wouldn't be a shower, and the person cutting down there would be cutting away, and you could be stopped here and you're looking for someplace else to go then that you can cut.
What's that telling you?
It's some sort of warning, you're shutting down.
Did I cause that?
No, he didn't know. Malting barley, the protein would have to be under 10.8.
Moisture content really matters. Dry enough and it'll be used to brew beer or distill whiskey. Too much moisture and it will have to be sold for much less as animal feed. The want of a few hours of drying weather can make or break a harvest.
The field of barley that we are in would hopefully go for malting. And that's why we're slow to cut it, because the moisture has to be under 21.4%.
Okay.
To cut it. So we've kind of been waiting around for the last week to cut that, to get the moisture down. And if that was going for feed, we would just cut it at 22 or 23%, because the time of the year it is, you just want to get it off the land.
And if you don't get it to the moisture level that you need it at, and you lose out on that 60 or 70 euro a ton premium, what does that mean for the profit and loss accounts for this year?
That's your profit. Like, you know, if you don't get it for malting, you're looking at break even or less. Like,
this year's chronically wet spring meant that Nicky couldn't get any seed in the ground in March. He should be finished harvesting by now, but he's only halfway through the job. And the later in autumn that you harvest, the greater the chance that rain will interrupt play.
Do you think the weather's changing?
I do, yeah. It's more extremes when we get rain now. We get a lot of rain. You never get that kind of nice soft day's rain where the ground is wet all day, but when you look in the gauge, there's only 3 or 4 mils in it. Like last Tuesday, you get 30, 40 mils, and it's just, it's extremes. And then we could get 6 weeks of dry weather. When you're looking for rain, then we don't seem to be getting those kind of 3 or 4 days of sunshine and maybe a soft day's rain, and you get back at it again the next day. And
Ten miles away from the home farm, a group of fields ripe with barley and oats shimmer in the face of a light sea breeze. Nicky's brother-in-law is out in the combine with a view of the salty islands for company. He's nearly finished the last field of oats when the weather turns.
Are you feeling that?
We've a mist just after starting here now, so there's 3 runs left in the field, so it's a race to get it finished now and move to the next place and hope that the shower hasn't landed there.
Yeah, some of those clouds are looking a little bit ominous.
Yeah, they are, and it's just the last couple of days, that's the way it's been, is that you'd be a shower here and a half mile on the road, the shower wouldn't have landed.
But this is how finely balanced it is. 3 runs left in this field. What is that, 10, 15 minutes at the most?
Yeah, that's it, yeah. Yeah.
But you might not be able to finish it.
No, like if that came in a heavy burst there now, by the time he spins on the headland and get around, he could be stopped, like, you know.
Well, we're in his way, let's not hold him up.
This is the lottery for Nicky, for all tillage farmers now. The later they sow because of a wet spring, the later they'll be harvesting, the more likely that they will be hit by rain as they do, and also the more likely that the fields will be hit by summer drought when the crop is just emerging from the soil. And as we've been reporting on Countrywide this year, the climate science now says that the odds of future winters being as wet as the last one are greater and greater. But Nicky is confident he has found a way to adapt.
On this farm, we've tried to go towards more regenerative farming, like sowing cover crops, a good crop rotation, trying to improve the soil health so that the soil can handle that excess rain, that if we can get the soil organic matter up and the structure of the soil better, it can hold more rain.
It's not damaged by the deluge and it retains moisture for the times of drought.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Like, I think for years we were sold, you know, machinery companies, the problems were fixed with machines or a spray can or a fertilizer bag, but that isn't there anymore. Like, for 50 years that was the answer, but I think we're moving away from that. We're being forced to move away from that.
Very big kind of philosophical change, isn't it? Instead of looking to technology to fix the problems, we're now turning back to nature and saying, what help can you give us here, please?
Yeah, exactly. I think there was always an answer along the way, either with a machine or a spray can or a fertilizer bag.
And that was progress.
Yes. I think that road is run out and it's going back to a more regenerative farming, less soil disturbance, less sprays.
Does it make you optimistic, though, that, like, I mean, you know that these weather conditions are going to persist, are probably only going to get even worse, but that using the approach that you are now, you can adapt?
Yeah, it does. Like, I see the improvements in the soil structure here. Like, the field that we're beside here hasn't been ploughed since 2016. The straw was chopped for the last 5 years on it. If there hasn't been a winter crop in it, it has a cover crop in it. It has a cover crop at the moment. It'll be being sowed on the 1st of April in it next
that
year.
That prevents soil erosion.
Yes, exactly. And runoff, you'll have less nitrogen going into the streams.
Are you making things harder for yourself if you don't do what you're
doing? Yeah, I think so. Anyway, yes, I do. I think it is going to get tougher. Soil conditions, deluges, everything else. There's a fear in it because all this is a financial risk by going that way. You can't just say, I'm going to go that way in the morning and farm regeneratively, because you have to make money at the end of the year. Otherwise, you won't be there. Your yields will go back a little bit maybe. You know, it's a very slow process. I'm not fully there at all yet, but we're working towards that. Like,
Nicky Keane in Wexford. And listening to that is the tillage editor of the Farmer's Journal, Siobhan Walsh. Good morning, Siobhan. How are you?
Morning, Philip. Thanks for having me on.
Nicky, what is true, Siobhan, of Nicky's farm, finally getting a bit of good weather this year, is not going to be true of everywhere else. What are you hearing about the rest of the country?
Sure. Look, Philip, I suppose spring barley is our biggest crop this year. We have 139,000 hectares, so it's over half of our cereal area because of the wet weather that we had. So people didn't get their winter crops in. They didn't get as much as usual in. Then we had a wet spring and late sowing. So the majority of farmers went for spring barley, which now means there's an awful lot of spring barley to be cut at the minute. And luckily we had those few days, 3.5 days basically last weekend to get some cutting done. And I would say a large amount of cutting was done last weekend, maybe about 65%. But for people who have crops left to cut, it's extremely difficult now. Like as we look out this morning, there's a really it's a hazy morning. There's a dew on the ground. As we go on in the year, we're in September now and days get shorter for cutting. And as days get shorter, it gets higher to get all those things that Nikki was talking about. So get your moisture down, and then, you know, quality goes down as the days get longer as well. And that means a loss in income. So it's just a bit more difficult, Philip.
There were some parts of the country that didn't even get those 3.5 days, though, last weekend, where they're thinking particularly of the Northwest. How did they do?
Absolutely. Yeah. Like, as the rest of us were cutting spring barley down this way, the north and northwest were still trying to cut their winter wheat, and their spring barley in many cases is still very green because it was sown so late. And I spoke to farmers in Donegal this week, and really up in that part of the country and parts of Derry, farmers are strongly thinking of getting out of tillage in those areas. So that's really disheartening to see. But the weather windows are just getting so much shorter. That's causing them, you know, that there's years where they're not getting their crops cut, and it's causing them to rethink their situation. Thankfully, Philip, there was some cutting going on up in Donegal yesterday, so that's good.
You know, though, that there's this kind of mix in farmers between endless optimism that it's going to get better next year and then always saying, oh, I'm going to get out of this game, I'm going to give it up. Which way do you think the balance is tipping? Are there people seriously thinking about getting into growing grass rather than cereals?
Well, look, the figures don't lie, Philip, and unfortunately we are seeing a decline in tillage area. And if you look at the cereal area for the last few years even, we'll go the full tillage area. So when I talk about tillage, I talk about the cereal crops, beet, potatoes, oilseed rape, all those things. This year we've seen a decline about 1%. Last year we saw about 0.5%. We had a kind of a false increase the year before, I think it was. We had that tillage incentive scheme the year of the war in Ukraine, which brought it up slightly, but overall, Philip, our tillage area is declining. So this year we're at about 343,000 hectares, where we would have been at 350 in 2022. And that has knock-on consequences for straw and all that kind of thing as well, Philip.
Indeed. I didn't play what Nikki had to say there about price, Siobhan, but he was very troubled by the price. Why is it, please explain to us, that when there are less tillage farmers, less land, as you say, under tillage, the weather is making things harder and harder for all of them, but demand is as high as ever for their crops. Why is it that the price that they are getting for their grain is getting lower and lower?
So in Ireland, we produce really high yields, really good quality grain. But unfortunately, because our tillage area is so small, we are still a net importer of feed. So we have a lot of animals in this country that all need to be fed. So we're importing, while we're producing 2 to 2.4 million tonnes of grain, possibly, we're importing about 5 million tonnes of grain. So we're competing on a world market. And as you know, while there is
so you're saying that it is the price of those imports that ends up determining the price of what is produced in this country?
Yeah, maybe not as simple as that, but basically, yeah. So we're competing. Basically, you know, if the price of wheat is dear, people will go to maize maybe that is cheaper and use that. And we have to get into a situation where there's a value placed on Irish grain and the quality of Irish grain, because and that would have come out of the Food Vision tillage report that was sent to the minister this year as well, a plan to help the tillage sector, because we're importing grain that's coming from countries maybe in South America that are GM, which we're not allowed to use in Ireland or Europe, and which is being sprayed with chemicals that have been banned in Ireland and Europe for many years. So Irish grain, you know, is much more traceable and safe than these other grains that are coming in.
Nikki's confident that the way to adapt to climate change is through regenerative farming. He has found a way for his farm, but his is a large farm. Might that not be the case for other smaller farmers?
Yeah, I think Nicky hit the nail on the head himself there. He said there is a hit on his profit as a result of going that way. And the majority of farms in Ireland and tillage farms in Ireland are small farms. People often have a picture of tillage farms being, you know, vast areas of land like we see in the US Midwest. In Ireland, there's an awful lot of tillage farms that are around the 30 hectare mark or between 30 and 60 hectares, which is small. You know, tillage really needs scale. So in order to be viable, they need to continue to do things like plough and get good establishment to maximise their yield. But still, farmers who, you know, I suppose ploughing sometimes is looked on as bad. There's a lot of small farmers in Ireland who might be ploughing to maximise their yields and maybe control grass weeds. But they're also doing things like planting cover crops, just like Nikki is, incorporating straw. And I would say, you know, part of the way we get out of this climate problem is more tillage in Ireland. And that's in our climate action plan, Philip. The government wants to increase tillage area by 50,000 hectares. They're just not doing very much about it because tillage is our lowest carbon emitting sector. Philip, it's about four times lower than beef, eight times lower than dairy. So if we had more tillage in this country, we'll produce less emissions, but we can also store more carbon in the ground. So those crops can take carbon dioxide out of the air and use their roots to put it down into the ground and store it and make us more climate resilient.
Indeed, Nicky figures, he hasn't done an audit yet, but he figures that he is at or as near to carbon neutral on his farm, over 900 acres as Dammit. So, you know, that's pretty impressive. Tell me though, all of this aside, what's the mood amongst tillage farmers? How do you assess, you know, their resilience, their mental health?
Tillage farmers are, I'd say they're an extremely resilient crowd, but this year has really tested them. And this year, you know, I speak to farmers and agronomists who deal with farmers all the time, and their mood has been a lot lower this year. And when you're looking at, you know, break-even yields are less on feed barley, you know, where people are renting land, they're losing large amounts of money on spring barley or those poor yielding winter crops. So the mood is extremely low, Philip. And I worry for the tillage sector at the minute. You know, if there isn't help coming in from government in some way this year, I think, which is unfortunate, tillage farmers don't want help from government. They want to be paid a good price for their product and make money, have a sustainable business. But unfortunately, I think if we don't get money from government this year in some way to pay the sector for doing those good climate things, then I think we will see another decline in tillage area this year because the losses will just be so high.
Indeed. All right. That's something that we're going to be looking at in the weeks ahead, is how is it that farmers can generate additional revenue from their farms for doing all of these things that we want them to do in the name of the environment and climate change. But Siobhan Walsh, tillage editor of the Farmers Journal, thank you very much for joining us this morning. Let's take a break.
Email countrywide at rte.ie. Countrywide on RTE Radio 1.
Just gone 8:30 if you are only just joining us. We have something very, very special and pleasant for you now. All summer long, Galway hookers and their smaller counterparts, Glowchogie, can be seen out on Galway Bay competing in the yearly regatta and sailing league organised by Cumann Hookery na Galava. The last race of the 2024 season at Féile an Tróthán in Onkararua saw the league title for one of the Glocho classes coming down to just two boats, the McHugh and Ceolnamara. All the great rivalries, all local, both crews knew each other really well, they race each other regularly, both are in with just as good a chance as the other. Now, Trasa Vranach hopped aboard the Ceolnamara to go to sea with the McDonagha brothers, Aidan, Brandon and Cian, as they pitted themselves against the crew of the McHugh. The weather was calmer than they would have liked. The stakes are high. The brothers were busy at work when Trasa arrived, and she began by asking Brandon about the league.
So we'd race every weekend, really, yeah. There's about probably 12 races in total throughout the summer. there's probably four or five boats that are able to win any day, and there's only seconds between us in every race, so it keeps us on our toes, you know.
This is a 23-foot Glotto called Kiol na Mara. The boat was built by my uncle in 85, 86, and she was sold twice, and then we bought her back again around 2003. So myself and my two younger brothers, I'm the eldest, Cian and Brendan, and we usually sail together in this one anywhere. There's a regatta between Roundstone, Keenvara, all around the Galway coast here.
It's nice being out. We've been sailing together now for probably 20 years. We started around, say when we were 10 years old, probably out with Aidan first. So he kind of showed us the ropes from day one.
The league this year, all down to this race, today.
Today is kind of D-Day, I suppose. There's two boats that are very tight in the league. There's only 1 point between us, so it will come down to the wire, yeah.
The McHugh, one of our competitors, if she wins first place today, that means she has the league. We need to finish either the second or third, or hopefully win it. And the league is over, so it should be a very good race today. We get on very good now with the McHugh and her crew. We've had some fierce battles over the years. The two boats are very close, so very interesting now that it's gone down to the last race of the season for the outcome. So looking forward to it. A bit nervous though. Now it's time to set sail now and rig her up for the race. We'll have to lift the mainsail here and then the jib to make sure everything's ready.
This boat is a 23-foot, so they're known as the Glotchuggy Bugger.
People might recognise the Galway hooker, the bigger Galway hooker.
So they all have the same sail plan, so it's a gaff rig on the mainsail and a jib and a foresail, but just different sizes sails and different size boats.
And it's the traditional red sails that people know from Galway Bay, really.
It is, yeah. There's actually a wide variety nowadays, whereas traditionally there would have been the old calico sails, which had a bit of a red tone, I suppose. But nowadays with newer material, you have white sails, wine colour sails like we have here, and again the red sails also.
Two sails up, the main sail and the jib. Are you putting up a foresail?
We will, yeah. So in every race, or most races anyway, you'd have the three sails up. They can sail with the jib and the main sail as well. So just before the race, we'll get going, make sure everything is right, and we'll get the foresail up then, just to test that before the race and get ready for the starting line then.
Hi Steve.
Have a
breeze.
I
see
you, Wanda. Keep going. So, fives are fast then. Fives are fast. Phone number warning.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll give it a chin. Emoshipshire.
Okay.
Class of heel.
You're getting rid of some of the ballast, I see, Brendan.
Yeah, we're taking a few, just a little bit of weight out. The wind seems to be dying off a bit, so it kind of helps with the weight of the boat. It'll just get our momentum going a bit easier, you know.
It's all about tactics today, you know. We have to get this right. There's no room for error today. We'll lighten her up, I think. It's calming off all the time.
So you're getting rid of all extra weight. Does that include me?
That includes you today, unfortunately, and even myself, if things are going against us.
Lads, best of luck. Good luck.
Oh, man. Had your fourth to all the one before it quit you.
Thanks, lads.
4, 3, 2, 1.
Okay, Wapalee.
I'm in the referee's boat now because I've been offloaded as ballast by Kiol na Mara, and with me is Stefan Dwalish, one of the referees on this race. All the bodhari, all the boatmen, all the sailors know each other, and I'm sure the referees on all of these races have a tough job.
They do, and you've hit the nail on the head. We all know one another, and some of us sail together as well, so it could be awkward later on after the races, but we'll eventually forget.
Stefan, we're well over halfway through the race now, and can you tell us what's going on?
Lovely day for sailing, and we're coming in on the last leg now, and things haven't changed too much. The boat in first place is the McHugh, and the boat in second place is Niamh Stefan, and at the moment in third is Kilnamara, but she has a bit of a fight on with the Nifain. So I'm sure the lads are under pressure at the moment, and it'll be interesting to see how it goes.
Ethan, Brendan and Cian, congratulations.
Thank you very much. Absolutely delighted. Unfortunately, we didn't come in first place. We came in third, which secured the league for us anyway, but a tough sail. Congratulations to the McHugh that won the race today.
So you lost the battle but won the war.
But a great season overall, great sailing. Everybody came home safe and it was a absolutely very enjoyable season this year.
Now, what did I tell you? Trasa Brannock on board, Kilnamara with the mighty McDonagh brothers. Gurmahagui Galair. Now, I am going to transport you for a few minutes to a future in which some of the biggest problems of food production might be more or less solved. For the last 3 days, there's been a conference in Dublin examining zoonotic diseases like avian flu, swine flu, COVID-19, the ones that can cross from animals to humans. One of the speakers at the conference, Professor Alison van Inenam from the University of California, UC Davis, spoke about the state of research which genetically alters livestock to remove or to reduce their susceptibility to all manner of diseases, things like TB, BVD, some of the biggest heartaches in farming, all potentially eradicated or at least controlled under a microscope rather than on the farm. And Professor van Inenam joins me in studio this morning at the end of that European Veterinary Immunology Workshop in Dublin. Good morning to you, Professor. Thanks for coming in to us. Big picture question to begin. What does the world look like 10 or 20 years from now if there is widespread adoption of this technology?
Yeah, thanks, Philip. I think what we're talking about here is using genetics to introduce useful characteristics into our livestock populations, and particularly with an emphasis on things like disease resistance. And this is done using a tool called genome editing, which enables scientists to basically tweak the genome of animals to make them not susceptible to disease.
Now, that is not without controversy, which we will come to, but let's look at the upsides first. Are we talking about controlling, reducing, or are we talking about potentially eradicating diseases?
Well, in some cases, we're looking at approaches where we would actually render the animals no longer susceptible to a virus. So the virus's entry point, where it actually gains access to the animal, would no longer be present in that animal. And that offers an opportunity to actually produce animals that are resistant to that particular virus.
What are you doing here? Are you knocking out the gene that makes them susceptible, or are you introducing new genes, or both?
Well, could be both, but the ones that are closest to market, I guess, are actually inactivating genes, where basically you've got a protein that is being expressed by the animal, and that is the target that the virus gains access to the animal. And so using genome editing, you can in a very targeted way go in and inactivate a component of that protein so that that entry side is just no longer present in the animal. And that's the opportunity that's offered.
Let's hone in on some of the specific diseases then. Bovine viral diarrhea costs the industry in this country over 100 million euro last year. What has been achieved there? What is possible?
So there was a paper that came out last year where scientists in the US have been able to tweak a gene. It's called CD46 for those that are really interested, which is, again, where BVD virus gains access to the animal. And by tweaking that naturally occurring gene in the animal, they're actually able to produce a variant that's no longer susceptible to BVD. And they've actually challenged the animal that's been edited in that way.
When you say challenge, you mean expose them to the virus?
Yeah, expose them to the virus along with a control animal that hadn't had the edit. And in fact, the animal that had the edit was not getting the virus, whereas the control animal was. And it's a small sample size.
Small sample size, so it's early days.
What's
the timeline? Assuming that there isn't regulatory pushback and assuming that everybody was to go and adopt this technology, what's the timeline on something like that actually taking hold in the marketplace?
Yeah, well, I think that's what's exciting to scientists is because we can go in and tweak the genome of an animal, we can actually tweak the genome for the next generation. And that offers the opportunity to, for example, do an edit and then the animal would be virus resistant. Now, to get it taken up in the industry amongst all the dairy cows, for example, obviously that would take some time to get industry adoption and to get that disseminated. But it really does speed up the ability to make these targeted changes.
5, 10, 15 years?
Yeah, well, it depends a little bit on the species we're talking about. Let's talk cattle, for example. So let's just say I have an animal that's going to be gestated for 9 months. So if I edit an embryo today, in you know, that'll be born.
So there's a kind of a 3-year turnaround before that cow is giving birth herself.
Exactly, in the case of cattle. So that's a 3-year generation interval.
Okay. I can't tell you how many programs we have done on TB and how much heartache it causes in this country. What is possible there?
Well, again, there's research at the development stage, in this case in China, where they've been able to introduce edits that enable animals to be less susceptible to tuberculosis. And so it's another opportunity to potentially use this technology to address that disease.
Less susceptible. We're not talking about getting rid of, just reducing an animal's susceptibility.
Yeah, and it's a little nuanced answer because it depends a little bit on the application we're talking about. In this case, the scientists exposed the animals, and the way it's worded is that they're less susceptible than actually resistant. Other examples, like the PRRS-resistant pigs, where you've inactivated a gene and that receptor is no longer there, those pigs are actually resistant to that virus.
Okay. Now, that's the good news, but there are going to be people listening to this who think this is just genetic modification and we don't like that in this part of the world. First things first, this is not transgenic mutation, is it? You're not taking the DNA out of a pig and putting it into a cow.
You're right. And yeah, there's a long history of the GM discussion. But yeah, that's traditional kind of genetic engineering, which has been around for about 30 years. And that traditionally did involve bringing in genetics potentially from another species into the animal. And in this case, what we're often doing is tweaking the naturally occurring genetic variation in the animal. So inactivating their own gene or protein so that they no longer have that virus.
So in a sense, you're really doing nothing different than if you were to introduce a number of bulls of different breeds into a field of cows and let them just go at it themselves.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, perhaps it's not well understood that natural genetic variation is the very basis of our livestock breeding programs. That's how we select better producing dairy cows, for example. And it's the basis of all animal breeding, the millions of genetic variations that exist between different animals. And really, this is working to introduce a useful trait in a very targeted way and then complement our conventional breeding programs.
Nonetheless, there will always be fears of unintended consequences here. How confident are you that there is going to be no impact on the food that these animals produce, on the milk and the meat?
Yeah, and always ask a scientist to give you a confident answer. But I think what we're talking about here is we're working with a naturally occurring genetic variation, like we're introducing disease resistance. We wouldn't expect that to have an effect on the milk or meat. And in fact, our lab has done research looking at animals we edited to not grow horns, so polled animals, and the milk and meat composition wasn't changed, as you would expect, because we already eat animals that don't grow horns, Angus, for example. And so we don't expect this to have a food safety aspect or alter the composition. Okay. We're just targeting the trait.
So it doesn't change, or hasn't in that particular experiment changed the milk or the meat. But we do know, don't we, that a single gene does not just find expression in a single trait in an animal. It can govern a number of different things. So if you change the susceptibility to tuberculosis, you might be changing other things that you haven't identified.
Yeah, that's called pleiotropy, where you have an effect of multiple effects of a gene. And that's certainly in animal breeding programs. We're always looking for negative correlations. So, for example, if you select for yield, you'll often have a bad effect on reproduction. And so you want to keep an eye on both and make sure you're not having a bad effect on other traits of economic importance in your breeding programs.
But ultimately, because you haven't been able to conduct an experiment where you produce these animals for generations and generations, you can't offer 100% guarantees, can you?
You can't. And the long-term safety guarantee is actually a scientific impossibility. So you can't prove a negative. What you can do is get data and have a look at the animal's performance and the characteristics of that animal and in under disease challenge and collect as much data as you can. But it's difficult for scientists to give you an absolute safety guarantee because you can't guarantee safety of anything.
The difficulty here might be that, you know, this technology exists. The genie is out of the bottle, if you like, and is going to be implemented. Do you see, if we were to get the heebie-jeebies about this in Europe, do you see the possibility that we're going to have two different markets in the world? One would be a disease-free or disease-reduced gene-edited market, and then the other would be a disease-prone non-gene-edited market.
Yes, that's happening. So there's a disease-resistant pig, a PRRS, that's porcine reproductive respiratory syndrome virus disease.
Very serious disease in the pig industry.
Yeah. And there's a company, Genus, that's publicly traded here in the UK, that is developing a disease-resistant line that'll be used in countries that have regulatory regimes that allow that to come to market, like Brazil and China and Argentina. But they're going to continue to produce pigs for the European market that will be susceptible to that disease. And so that's already happening potentially.
We are, aren't we then, in effect, having some kind of influence or control in those other markets by saying, we're not going to allow you to sell those products in this part of the world?
I think that's a bit of a pessimistic take. I don't think that the European Commission has made their final determination as to how they're going to actually regulate this technology. So there have been some earlier decisions suggesting they might regulate it all as we did with genetic engineering. But there's also a move, and certainly many scientists supporting an approach that if you could have achieved that same edit using conventional breeding, that it shouldn't be treated differently to conventional breeding. And so if that does go through, then there's the potential that we could introduce things like PRRS resistance without having the GM stigma.
Finally, though, while there are concerns here, there's an upside, a very big upside for animal welfare, for human health, for wildlife welfare, if we don't have to cull as many badgers any longer, for farmer welfare, for environmental welfare.
Well, I mean, I would argue disease resistance really ticks the three pillars of sustainability. So it's better for the animals, better for the farmers, and better for the environment because you don't have animals getting sick and needed to be treated with antibiotics. So it's kind of a triple win.
Indeed. Professor Alison van Inenam, thank you very much for joining us this morning. Of course, the row over genetically modified crops and cereals has been well played out in Europe over the past two decades. And in that time, the number of people producing vegetables in Ireland has grown smaller and smaller. There were 400 at the end of the 1990s. There's just 60 now, at a time when we know that we need to be introducing more plant-based meals into our diet. It is unusual to hear about young people then getting into commercial vegetable growing, even more unusual to hear that they are expanding their commercial vegetable growing businesses, and even more unusual still in the case of Brian McCarthy to hear that he is expanding his business from a quarter of an acre on a rooftop in Cork city centre to taking over a whole 60-acre dairy farm. This was Brian on Countrywide talking to Suzanne Campbell, this time 4 years ago.
We made a business plan around the end of May. We really started to look into how we could turn a profit out of 6,800 square feet, because whereas that's a lot of space in the city centre in terms of a farm, it's absolutely tiny. It's like it's not even a quarter acre. So it's a challenge to make money out of that area. But one big thing we have going for us is location, and that we are right smack bang in the middle of Cork city centre.
That was Brian 4 years ago, and you could hear from the cars in the background he was on that quarter acre rooftop in Cork city centre. But now he has 60 acres to play with. And this week, Hannah Quinn Mulligan went to see him stretch his arms.
We've grown about 3 acres of carrots here. So there's two sowings. We did one in May and one in July.
And you're talking about this in a very matter-of-fact way. I'm looking at like a vast field of carrots.
Yeah.
I cannot grow one row of carrots. My carrots fail every single year. Like, it is not an easy thing to grow vegetables. I think we need to put that into proportion.
It's definitely not an easy thing to grow vegetables. And in this year especially, it's been very challenging. And I guess we're getting used to the different conditions and the different environmental conditions, as well as the different soil and field conditions here on the farm. It's our first year.
Take me back a few years, though. How did this actually begin for you? Cork Rooftop Farm.
Yeah, so it started literally the week that the country got locked down in March of 2020. So I have a fresh cut flower business, and we had to close that temporarily. And to save myself from climbing the walls, I started growing some fruit and vegetables on the rooftop of the former premises.
Was that in Cork City Centre?
Yeah, maybe? Right in the heart of Cork City Centre. So my apartment literally backed onto it and had all this space. So I started growing fruit and veg up there. No, formal background in farming or horticulture. Basically anything that I had been exposed to had been at a kind of an amateur scale, kind of my own father or my grandmother, things like that. So did a very deep dive, I would say, and have been continuing to dive deeper ever since.
You've gone from a rooftop to how many acres?
Yeah, 60 now, and it's
in what, 2-3 years?
Yeah, we're in year four, but I'm we're going to have to press pause on the growth of land, and just I think certainly the next few years is going to be all about really honing in and consolidating what we're doing and trying to perfect the processes and the systems we have in place on the farm.
So you're relatively young as well.
Yeah, well, I'm 38, so I feel young anyway. Whatever about the number getting larger, but we've quite ambitious plans for the farm. Over the coming years, it is a long-term plan, I guess, for the farm. We've a long-term lease with that in mind, which I guess is unusual.
And you took over from a dairy farm.
Correct, yeah. So this has been in dairy for generations beforehand. So the whole farm was in grass. So that was our initial challenge in the spring, and coming out of the wettest spring in living memory to try and get contractors in to get the land out of grass and into something that we could plant a seed or a plant into was challenging. And we probably, in fear of not getting them at all, we kind of rushed ahead a bit in that. And so that was probably the first hiccup of the start of the year.
And is this the machine then that you got funding from the Department of Agriculture for? Yeah. And so what is it exactly?
Well, it kind of looks like something you'd see out of photos from, moon landings or something.
That's
like
exactly,
that.
Exactly, yeah, yeah, or an early Star Wars film or something.
But
yeah.
It's quite different to a tractor anyway. But
it does, I should say, explain, it has four wheels and then it has, I guess, a control.
Console, yeah,
a console panel, and it has kind of a joystick that you can, I guess, navigate for it to go. And then there is, how many metres? Would we say that's 3 metres?
It's 3.5 metres roughly squared.
And it's on solar panels on top of the four wheels.
Yeah, so during the summertime it's fully sufficient for its power, so we don't it can run 24/7 using these panels, just with the long days and the even with the gray summer we've had.
Is it self drive or
it is yeah it's okay. All automated, so it you plot out your field, you then tell, you put in your conditions, so it depends on what you're sowing, and it automatically sows the field for you.
Wow. Does anyone need to be here when it's doing that?
You do need to keep an eye on it. It's very hard to just walk away and just leave it blindly do it. We did do it with the kale and it worked,
I remember visiting a vegetable farmer and I was kind of blown away by the fact that he could point to a row of potatoes and he'd know exactly how much profit and loss he was going to make from that row, or a salad or anything like that. I mean, are you making enough money? Are you going to make enough money?
I suppose the thing with jumping to this scale is you have to also scale your sales then, and you also have to scale your labour, you have to scale your post-harvest, so the costs go up as well as everything else. You can't really target those large customers for product until you have the scale of product available, or till you can guarantee that quality. So there's been a bit of chicken and egg happening this year on that side, but we've been able to grow into it. We do have a couple of large contracts that are going to be starting now in the next month or two, which is going to help us enormously. But it is that thing of just getting off the ground with it, and you have to. There's huge risk in that approach. There's huge risk, but I'm quite committed to the Cork Rooftop Farm business and the project that we've been driving with it, and trying to show that it can be done despite market trends and despite the trends of people leaving vegetable growing in their droves, and that it can be done at a scale as well that can feed a lot of people. I think that's really important. You know, we were doing the market gardening, and it's no slight in market gardening, and like there's a lot of great market gardeners around the country, but we're in Cork City here, and there's 250,000 people living in the city, and in most of the supermarkets that they go to buy their fruit and veg, they can't get access to locally grown produce, and I just feel that that's an absolute complete shame, and someone has to turn that around.
Indeed. Hannah with Brian McCarthy on the new farm in Cork. A man full of good ideas. And we do not have a monopoly on good ideas here. We are always willing to hear and listen to and explore your ideas countrywide at rte.ie if there are things that you think that we should be turning our attention to. Countrywide at rte.ie. That is all that we have time for this week. Amandine Passo-Devine pulled the weeds. Mark McGrath cleaned the muck off the spuds. Brenda Donoghue got our wares to market. Brian O'Connell has your playback selection after the news. Until the same time next week, have a great weekend.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1. Listen back on the RTE Radio Player.